recorded these stories for us in the first place. We're talking about men that lived a long time ago. We're talking about men that lived in specific circumstances that are different from those that we live in today. But at the same time, we're talking about human tendencies that don't change, human responses to things that are similar from age to age, no matter what the changes in the window dressing of a given society. And most of all, we're talking about a God who doesn't change. And so what God has done, and we said last night, God communicates with us in different ways to try to get his point across to us. But one of the ways in which he communicates with us that we can relate to so easily is to tell us stories about men who went through various difficulties and trials and challenges, and to help us to see certain principles as they're actually being acted out. One of the tendencies that we have to fight in studying, as we're doing, is to think that these are just fiction. We get used to hearing about Joseph. We get used to hearing about Job, who we talked about last night. We sometimes grow up with these personalities from the Scriptures, and it can be easy for us to set them aside and put them in a different category and see them as something other than similar to what we are. And that is a mistake that will separate us from these men and will not allow us to get the full benefit of the things that they have endured in their lives. And so God records these stories for us of men that lived millennia ago, because he knows that we're not really that different, and that there are things to learn from doing what we're doing this week. And that's to go back and look at these stories and try, as we're trying to do this week, put ourselves in the shoes or the sandals, as the case may be, of these men, and try to see ourselves in their culture and facing the challenges that they were facing then, because we are too. And in our day. And I hope that we'll see that tonight in looking at the story of Joseph. Have you ever heard someone excuse a criminal for some vile act that he has committed by saying something like, well, you know, we're all guilty of this crime. The thing this man has done is extremely horrible, but, you know, we all have to take responsibility in this crime because society has made this man what he is. And what we're trying to say, I think erroneously in that kind of an explanation, is that we're nothing more than the product of our environment, which is pretty much an evolutionary outlook on human life. If we rule God out of the equation, then the evolutionary model is valid. And if it is valid, then it is true that we are nothing more than the result of mindless forces acting upon the environment and creating even human beings. And so taking God out of the equation, we are what society has made of us. But if there is a God, then we choose what we become, and we are going to be responsible for that choice. And of course, those of us that are gathered here tonight would firmly and strongly believe in the latter, that there is a God. And the fact that there is a God means that we are not an accident of circumstance, that we're not just the product of our environment, and we are responsible for what we choose. And I think we can see that working in the life of Joseph. Would you open your Old Testaments with me to Genesis chapter 37, where we're introduced to the story of Joseph's late teenage years and adulthood that we'll be looking at in our lesson tonight. And the first point I want to consider with you, and really to establish the foundation of some other observations we'll make a little bit later, is simply this, that in the example of Joseph, we have an individual rising above his environment. That if anybody that we can read about in the Bible had cultural, family, environmental issues that could have impeded his progress in godliness and would have been an excuse for him disobeying God and living a life that would not have been pleasing to God. If we could say that about anybody, surely we could say it about Joseph. So let's take a few minutes at the beginning. We're going to look at various elements of Joseph's nurturing and his environment that could have led him truly far afield from God. First thing to notice in Genesis 37 is verses 3 and 4. Let's look at Joseph's place in his family. Now, Israel loved Joseph more than all his children because he was the son of his old age. Also, he made him a tunic of many colors. But when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, they hated him and could not speak peaceably to him. Showing favoritism toward one or more of our children as opposed to the others is a disservice to any child for the very reason that we read about right here. And believe me, it can be a temptation for a parent. If you have more than one child, you will begin to see that however many you have, they're each individuals. And there will be some traits of some of your children that you might be more drawn to than the traits of others of your children. And what a parent must do is have the maturity not to treat one of those children in a more special way than the others. Because if we do that, we are really going to create many, many problems for ourselves and many problems for our children. And we spoke of Noah on Sunday, and we said it's a story that tends to lend itself to being a children's story, though there are very adult themes in the story of Noah. And as in that case, so in this case, probably if we were raised by Christian parents, we have heard the story of Joseph in his coat of many colors for a long time, and it just lends itself, you know, to making certain visual aids for children to demonstrate Joseph's special coat. But that special coat created a lot of trouble because it was indicative of Joseph's favorite place in the structure of the family and with his father. Joseph, we are told in this context, is 17 years old in verse 2. And I'll suggest to you as we develop our thoughts this evening that the next 13 years, especially of Joseph's life, are going to be very difficult as an outgrowth of this place of favoritism. Well, the favoritism, as we've indicated here, leads to sibling rivalry, but it's not only the favoritism that has been shown to Joseph. Back in verse 2, at the end of that verse in chapter 37, it says Joseph brought a bad report of his brothers to his father. And then coming down a little bit further, in verses 5 through 8, Joseph further complicates his own problems with his brothers. Now, Joseph dreamed a dream, and he told it to his brothers, and they hated him even more. So he said to them, "Please hear this dream which I have dreamed. There we were, binding sheaves in the field. Then behold, my sheaf arose and also stood upright, and indeed your sheaves stood all around and bowed down to my sheaf." And his brothers said to him, "Shall you indeed reign over us? Or shall you indeed have dominion over us?" So they hated him even more for his dreams and for his words. For a long time, I thought this was extremely inadvisable on Joseph's part, that he would share the content of those dreams. And the idea of being next to last in line in age, and yet his brothers bowing down to him ran completely counter to the culture of the day. And I thought, you know, was that the smartest thing to do on Joseph's part, is to tell his brothers the nature of this dream where they were all bowing down to him? And I don't know that I've got any solid answer to this, but I would at least throw this out for your consideration. As we go through the story of Joseph, he is proven to be a prophet of God. And was there, or should there have been, an expectation on the part of his brothers to recognize the prophetic nature of the dreams? I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. I do think as we go down through the story, it is fortuitous, although right now it's not. But later it'll be fortuitous that Joseph did tell his brothers the nature of that dream, because you know how the story ends up. They are going to bow down to Joseph one day. But at 17 years old, telling your brothers that, it's probably not the message they wanted to hear. And again, it leads to all sorts of difficulty for Joseph. Then, of course, further down in chapter 37, we have the story of Joseph being abandoned. And I say that, it sounds rather light to put it that way. He almost was murdered by his brothers. Abandonment was the least worst option. They wanted to kill him. Go down to verses 18 through 20. Joseph is sent to his brothers out in the field, and when they saw him afar off, in verse 18, even before he came near them, they conspired against him to kill him. Then they said to one another, "Look, this dreamer is coming. Come, therefore, let us now kill him and cast him into some pit, and we shall say, some wild beast has devoured him. We shall see what will become of his dreams." And if they had any inkling that Joseph was a prophet, now they're flying in the face of God. They're mocking him for dreams that will turn out to be prophetic dreams. And then in verses 21 and 22, Reuben intervenes. He heard of it, and he delivered him out of their hands and said, "Let us not kill him." And Reuben said to them, "Shed no blood, but cast him into this pit, which is in the wilderness, and do not lay a hand on him, that he might deliver him out of their hands and bring him back to his father." When we start building the story here and we see what befalls Joseph, am I too far off the mark to say that in some ways in our society we seem to be emotionally and mentally very fragile? We hear a lot in our day and time about self-esteem and how easily it can be infringed upon or destroyed. And we're so worried about saying just, you know, the wrong word and somebody's going to be totally ruined by it. Or a parent makes a mistake and they're going to traumatize their child and they're going to be damaged for life. I mean, we hear a lot of that from a psychological, a humanistic psychological standpoint. How about being abandoned by your brothers? And that, just short of being murdered by them. And then as the story, of course, goes on, though Reuben has tried to find a way to protect Joseph and return him safely back to the family, we find the brothers, in Reuben's absence, carry through with a plan to actually sell him into slavery. And so later on, Midianite traders come by and Joseph is sold. What do you think that might do to your psyche? It's one thing to be called a name. It's another thing to have your brothers sell you. And so we begin thinking about what all is piling up on Joseph that is extremely emotionally and even spiritually, as we study along, very burdensome to him. And I suggest to you that generally speaking, we are and ought to be much more emotionally and mentally strong than we turn out to be. And I don't really know why we're not. I'm sure that's a very complicated question and a complicated answer that we don't have time to go into tonight. But it seems to me that we're fairly fragile. And that gives me a lot of strength and hope when I read about the strength of a man like Joseph and what he faces and what he is able to overcome. Well, let's go down to Genesis 39. This, of course, is the famous story with Potiphar's wife. Joseph is eventually a servant in the house of Potiphar in Egypt. And being a man of character, he rises to a responsible position as a household steward. And serving in that capacity, we find in verses 7 through 15 that he is approached eventually by Potiphar's wife, trying to subvert him morally. Let's read verses 7 through 15 of chapter 39. "Now it came to pass after these things that his master's wife cast longing eyes on Joseph, and she said, 'Lie with me.' But he refused and said to his master's wife, 'Look, my master does not know what is with me in this house, and he has committed all that he has to my hand.'" Now stop there. A man of lesser spiritual conviction might have used that very principle to give in to Potiphar's wife. Everything he has is in my hand. I've got the power and the ability to carry out what this woman is wanting me to do, and he'll probably never find out. But that's not the way Joseph reasons. Verse 9, there's no one greater in this house than I, nor has he kept back anything from me but you, because you are his wife. How then, one of the great statements in the Bible with conviction, how then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God? Well, we know something about Joseph at this point in his life early on. He has not turned against God because of what's happened to him. He still is very, very strong and very sensitive in his conscience toward God. And though he might have gotten away with it because of his position, you see, Joseph isn't a product of circumstance, is he? He's a man of conviction, not a product of circumstance. And the circumstance might have allowed him to commit adultery and get away with it. But Joseph operates on a higher basis than merely his surroundings. And he says, I might be able to hide it from my master, but I can't hide it from God. How can I do this and sin against God? So it was as she spoke to Joseph day by day. You know, we can sometimes fight that temptation off today, but it comes back tomorrow. And we might be able to fight it off tomorrow, but it comes back the day after that. And then we might begin thinking, well, I guess it's never going to go away, so I may as well give in. As she spoke to Joseph day by day, he did not heed her to lie with her or be with her. But it happened about this time when Joseph went into the house to do his work and none of the men of the house was inside. She caught him by his garment, saying, lie with me. But he left his garment in her hand and fled and ran outside. Verses 19 and 20. So it was when his master heard the words which his wife spoke to him, accusing Joseph of trying something he didn't do. Your servant did to me after this manner. His anger was aroused. Joseph's master took him and put him into the prison, a place where the king's prisoners were confined, and he was there in prison. No good deed goes unpunished, right? You ever done the right thing, and the response you get is some kind of penalty? It's frustrating, isn't it? And here's Joseph having done exactly the right thing, having gone through everything he's gone through to this point in time, but rising as far as he could rise in his present circumstances, and then, boom, back down to the bottom. He is unceremonially pounded back to the bottom of the ladder. By what? A false accusation. You ever had somebody tell a lie about you? You ever had somebody say something about you that wasn't true for whatever reason? Isn't that frustrating? It makes you feel helpless. It makes you feel that the essence of who you are has been marred. And then you're concerned about your influence and what others will think about you and the conclusions that they will draw about you. And here's Joseph doing everything right. And what this proves to us is the age-old principle that life is not fair. And people are going to treat us unkindly for their own purposes. And the question is, what are we going to do about it? Are we going to blame God for that? Are we going to be embittered by that? Are we going to be like them and do unto others before they do unto you? What choice are we going to make given the fact that life is this way? And if you haven't had it happen to you yet, you will. Someone is going to lie about you or otherwise misrepresent you in a way that's going to be very, very hurtful to you. And this is more than hurtful in Joseph's life. This is another element of injustice done to this young man. In Genesis chapter 39, again, verses 21 and 22, the Lord was with Joseph and showed him mercy, and he gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison. And the keeper of the prison committed to Joseph's hand all the prisoners who were in the prison. Whatever they did there, it was his doing. Sounds like his place in Potiphar's household, right? What does that tell us? It tells us that Joseph still has not compromised himself because of his circumstances. You know, we hear today in our society that prison is not remedial. It reinforces criminal habits. It retards one's ability to function in real life. And you know what that is? It's more of the same. We're products of our environment. A criminal is just made more of a criminal by being put in prison. Another argument against human free will and the ability to choose what we will do: Joseph wasn't made more of a criminal by being put in prison under false accusations. Again, he rises as far as he can rise in his circumstances. Listen to what I'm saying. If your circumstances are digging a ditch, dig the best one you can dig. Go as far as you can go in the circumstances that you are in at present. That's all anybody can do. And that's what Joseph does over and over. He takes the circumstances that are being dealt to him. These things, these are hands being dealt to Joseph. He's not creating this problem. He's doing the right thing and being knocked down for it time and time again. But in every one of those situations, he does the best he can do, and he rises as far as he can rise in that circumstance. Joseph's life is not supportive of the idea that we're just products of our environment. In his imprisonment, another injustice occurs. And this, of course, has to do with the interpretation of the dreams of the butler and the baker, which are not Joseph's doing. This is God's doing. And Joseph is further being confirmed as a prophet of God. And God is willing to reveal things to him that other human beings would not know. In this case, what's going to be the outcome of these men's lives and their dreams? And Joseph does interpret the dreams correctly. In chapter 40, let's go to verses 14 and 15. In verses 9 down through verse 13, the butler is telling Joseph the nature of his dream. And Joseph interprets that correctly, as it will turn out. But in verse 14, Joseph says to the butler, "But remember me when it is well with you. And please show kindness to me and make mention of me to Pharaoh and get me out of this house." Now look, we don't have to like the circumstances that we're in. And some people, have you met them? They sort of plaster a smile on their face and they go through life being happy about everything. And I wonder, what planet are you on? There are things that happen in this life, like we talked about with Job last night, that are miserable. And I don't think being optimistic or hopeful or joyful as a Christian means that we just love every circumstance we're in. This life can deal us a nasty hand. And Joseph does not want to be in prison. He's going to make the best that he can of it, and he's not compromising his faith in God, but he'd rather be somewhere else if he had the choice. And so he asks the butler, "Would you please put in a good word for me?" Which he doesn't. And I've wondered through the years in reading this story, how could you forget someone interpreting a dream correctly? A dream in which it was communicated to you that your life was going to be spared and your buddy was not going to be spared and the baker was hanged. How do you come out of that circumstance of almost being executed and forget the guy that interpreted your dream? But that's what happened. Verse 23 says, "The chief butler did not remember Joseph, but forgot him." Verse 1 of chapter 41 says, "Then it came to pass at the end of 2 full years that now Pharaoh has his famous dream." 2 years. You know, you can read past that real quick. Like, Noah, I want you to build an ark. And you don't really get the fullness of that. Abraham, I want you to go out to a land that I'll show you. And you don't really get the fullness of that. 2 more years went by where Joseph, probably to some degree, I would think, being an average human being, could stew over being forgotten, being a victim of ingratitude. And surely bitterness could have crept in from the butler's selfishness. But in all of this time, what is happening is that Joseph is being prepared for something greater. He's being prepared for something greater. He's also being prepared for greater challenges that are going to come to him. So turn with me to chapter 41. I would suggest to you that of all of the items that we have here on the screen concerning difficulties that Joseph had to deal with, this may be the most dangerous one of all. It is now the opportunity that Joseph has to rise in power, in prominence, to rise really to a position of leadership over all of Egypt. The nuts and bolts, that was being handled by Joseph, will be. Pharaoh, like Potiphar and like the keeper of the prison, are going to turn it all over to Joseph. And all of what he has been through really has prepared him for the greatest challenge and the greatest opportunity of his life. So in chapter 41, let's read verses 39 and following. After Joseph interprets the dreams of Pharaoh correctly, Pharaoh said to Joseph, "Inasmuch as God has shown you all this, there is no one as discerning and wise as you. You shall be over my house, and all my people shall be ruled according to your word. Only in regard to the throne will I be greater than you." And Pharaoh said to Joseph, "See, I have set you over all the land of Egypt." Then Pharaoh took his signet ring off his hand and put it on Joseph's hand. And he clothed him in garments of fine linen and put a gold chain around his neck. And he had him ride in the second chariot which he had. And they cried out before him, "Bow the knee." So he set him over all the land of Egypt. Pharaoh also said to Joseph, "I am Pharaoh, and without your consent, no man may lift his hand or foot in all of the land of Egypt." Verse 46, Joseph was 30 years old when he stood before Pharaoh, king of Egypt. Remember I said the next 13 years are going to be tough? Joseph was 30 years old and the most powerful man on earth, save for one. And again, this perhaps is the greatest danger that he faces in his life to date. I'd like us to think about what James Dobson calls life's critical decade, from years 16 through 26. James Dobson is a man, and I don't put all that much credence in this particular decade because he says so, but I'll tell you what, I've lived through that decade. It's now getting to be quite a while ago, but I've lived through that decade of 16 through 26. And some of you are in it. Some of you are beginning to find out some of the difficulties of that decade of your life. And I don't strongly disagree with James Dobson. I think it is life's critical decade for reasons that we'll suggest to you. But keep in mind, this pretty much was the decade that Joseph lived through, all of these trials and indignities and all the rejection and the separation, not only from his family, but his culture and his homeland. By the time his brothers come to Joseph, he is an Egyptian. He's not an Egyptian in his religion, but in his culture, he's an Egyptian. When his brothers will first come in, and even until he reveals himself to them, they don't recognize him. Why is this particular decade so critical? I would suggest to you, in general, it is because the foundation for the rest of our adult life is often laid. I'm not saying exclusively. I realize fully the early years of nurturing in our family by our parents is extremely important. What parents begin to instill in children from the time they're able to reason, and through those earliest years and their gradual development up to, into, and through adolescence, those are all important years. I'm not trying to say this is the only decade of importance, okay? But what I am saying is, during this time, you, if you're in that age, and we who have already passed through it, we probably pretty well, on our own, by our own choices, Not by the nurturing of someone else, but by our own choices, we have set in motion certain things in life that will characterize the rest of our life on earth. So many of those things happen in this particular decade. First of all, one chooses their moral and value system in general as an independent adult during this particular time of life. One's spiritual orientation often becomes seated. I'm not saying it'll never change and it'll never grow. It must grow and it must mature. But in this decade, we begin to set habits for ourselves by our own choice. Some of you that are new, perhaps, to being on your own, you're beginning to learn that mom and dad aren't there to oversee your every decision. They're not there to get you up on Sunday morning. They're not there to make you do your homework or work on your paper or free your time up to be at a gospel meeting or to be at worship on Wednesday evening. And I will say I'm thrilled to see as many of you youngsters, we oldsters can say that now, but to see you young folks here tonight, it's very encouraging to me because it shows that you're beginning to set good habits for yourself. I would dare say that for those of you that are here in that particular decade, your parents probably don't know that you're here unless your parents are here. And what that means is you made this decision for yourself to come. But whatever decisions we make during the late teen and early 20s years, we're beginning to set a direction for the rest of our lives. And we're doing it because of choices. Our self-concept as an adult is being formed. Let me tell you, I remember very clearly how difficult some of that was. To not see myself as a teenager anymore and not see myself as Laureen Jonas's son, but to see myself now as an adult. To know that I now live in a cultural context where my mother is not present. I'm not my mother's son when I go away from school. I am Jim Jonas. Now I'm somehow related to the Jonas brothers, so you never get past that completely. Had a little girl call the house the other day wanting to know if that's where the Jonas brothers lived. Poor thing. I hated to tell her no. I know she was crushed. But during this time, we are beginning to decide for ourselves who we are and what direction our lives are heading. How am I perceived now that I'm among a new set of peers and now I'm in a new congregational setting, perhaps, if I've gone off from home? How am I being perceived by other people? I'm not just the child in the Jonas family now. I'm Jim Jonas and nobody knows anything about my family. What perceptions are being drawn about me? What am I projecting to other people because of the decisions that I'm making, because of the character that I display? What are my qualities? I know what my parents' qualities are, and I know what qualities my parents want me to have. But what are my qualities? And those are some very challenging questions that we begin answering by the choices that we make. We begin answering these questions. What our values are and what our characteristics are and what our integrity is. We begin answering those questions because of the circumstances we're in and the decisions that we make. And of course, decisions are made on our higher education, what our major is going to be, and what that may do in establishing a career path and a life path. Our financial habits are often established. We begin to learn about self-control or the lack thereof with the money that we have available. I'll spare you the way back when I was in college stories. But I've been there and done that. The only part of that I'll tell you is I went to school on veterans and Social Security benefits because my father died when I was 10 years old. I got one check from the government. Well, I got two checks, Social Security and VA, but I got those once a month. And if they ran out during week three, the next one wasn't coming till the first of the next month. And you had to figure out how to make whatever you had stretch till you had another infusion of income. And certainly not least, but the last in our list, our marriage partner is usually chosen during that period. I realize that number's bumping up a little bit, 25, 26, 27. You know, it's getting a little bit older, but still, so many times, this is the decade in which maritally the rest of our life is going to be set. And I'll tell you, that will be the greatest influence on earth of the rest of your life. This is not a lesson on choosing a mate per se. But I've been married 27 years now, through four children and living in other countries and doing a variety of things. I'm going to tell you, this choice should not be taken lightly. It will affect the rest of your life on earth. It'll take you into places in your experience you can't even begin to imagine, not having lived through those years yet. And I understand, there's no way you can make a decision on who you marry with 25 years of marital experience behind you. That's not the way this works. So on what basis you make this decision is going to be very important. What are the criteria that is in your mind as you begin to approach that question, who am I going to marry? Well, what's your criteria? What's important to you? What are your values? What are you striving to be spiritually? What's your view toward God? And what's the view of your prospective mate in those things? Do they blend? Do they mesh? Is it hormonal only? What's important to you? What are your values? What are your choices? What is your direction of life? And how does this choice I'm about to make that the Lord expects to be for life, how does that potentially affect me 10, 15, 20 years down the road? And again, I know none of us have that kind of perfect insight to see that far, but we do need to understand that there are ramifications to the choices that we make in life. And a lot of the most important decisions that set the stage for the rest of our life on earth are going to be formulated in this particular decade. Regardless, here's the overall point of the sermon tonight, but regardless of our family structure, our economic status, our academic achievements, our physical appearance, our peers, whatever environmental factors that influence us, regardless of those, we are responsible for the choices that we make that set us on this path through adulthood. We are responsible. We are not merely the product of our environment. Evolutionary thinking is ungodly. We cannot just discharge our responsibility and say, you know, I'm not accountable for that because this happened to me and that happened to me and this happened to me and that happened to me. Well, I know it, from our sermon last night, especially about Job, I know bad things happen. And sometimes our home life and our nurturing by our parents is not what it should have been. And some grow up in very disadvantaged circumstances, spiritually, emotionally. I understand that. But what does Joseph teach us? We can come out of difficult environmental situations and still make good choices because God is where He belongs in our thinking. We do not have to just react and go through life continuing the process of suffering because we fail to put God where He belongs in our thinking. So where did Joseph's stability come from? First, his belief in God's Word. And going back, I think, even to the dream that we read about in chapter 37. I think there was an undying confidence and assurance that what he had seen from God in that dream would, in fact, come about. You notice that because God had revealed this to Joseph, did not mean that he was shielded from difficulty. But I think we learn in Joseph that he never measured the Word of God by his circumstances. This is something Job struggled with and his friends struggled with. And we talked about this last night, measuring God by the circumstances instead of measuring the circumstances by God. But what a temptation it would have been for Joseph to begin to doubt God, not seeing how in the world being sold into slavery, imprisoned, falsely accused, forgotten in ingratitude, and all the other things that happened to him, how in the world is this going to further this dream that I had of all these sheaves bowing down to me? We said in earlier lessons how Noah must have felt when he had done the work that God gave him to do, and then it started raining. How did Abraham feel when God commanded him to offer Isaac as a burnt offering, and he went through with it in intent, but God stopped him? How do you think he felt then? How do you think Joseph felt when his brothers came in and he recognized them and they bowed down at his feet? Remember, that's another 9 years after he becomes ruler of Egypt. That's another 9 years. 7 years of good and 2 years of famine. So he's 39 and all this began happening at 17. Do you think Joseph was happy that he had made the right choices when he looked down and his brethren, according to the dream, were bowing at his feet? And I think in all of this, what we see is that Joseph is able to appreciate God's blessings over man's mistreatment. He did not blame God for what had happened to him. If you look at chapter 39, beginning in verse 2, the Lord was with Joseph, and he was a successful man, and he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. His master saw that the Lord was with him, and that the Lord made all he did to prosper in his hand. So Joseph found favor in his sight and served him. Then he made him overseer of his house, and all that he had he put in his hand. God didn't release him from being a slave of Potiphar, but he blessed him in Potiphar's house. God did that for Joseph, though his brothers had sold him. You know what so many people choose today? They choose to magnify the difficulty or the hardship or the setback and then accuse God of not being there to help them. Joseph didn't do that. We also saw in chapter 39, in Joseph's resistance to Potiphar's wife, his devotion to God's moral law. How easy would it have been to have rationalized laying with Potiphar's wife? There's any number of rationalizations that Joseph could have come up with, but he didn't. Because his devotion to God's moral law, which grows out of his devotion to God personally, was too strong for that. Joseph continued to glorify God, and I will not read all the references, but in chapter 40 and verse 8, 41, verse 16, 25, 28, and 32, every time Joseph gets an opportunity, he's telling people, it's not of me. God is the one that interprets dreams. Daniel did the same thing many years later. It's not of me. God does this. And he gives glory and he gives credit to God where that is due. But hurrying through that, I want us to go on to chapter 44 and read this, because this is as good as drama gets, folks. Hollywood can't come up with anything to touch this. I cannot read this story. It may be in the privacy of my home when I'm doing my daily Bible reading, and I get to this story, I read it, and I break out in goosebumps all over. It is one of the most dramatic moments in the history of mankind, in my opinion. What has happened, what has transpired, what is leading up to this moment, from just the standpoint of human emotion and drama, folks, you can't beat this. Chapter 44 of Genesis, let's begin reading in verse 18. Then Judah came near to him and said, O my Lord, please let your servant speak a word in my Lord's hearing. And do not let your anger burn against your servant, for you are even like Pharaoh. And let me stop. Historically, you know where this is. Joseph is demanding that Benjamin be left with him, and he'll let the other brothers go back. And now Judah, who was the one who had been so vocal against Joseph earlier, is now the one interceding. My Lord asked his servant, saying, Have you a father or a brother? And we said to my Lord, We have a father, an old man, and a child of his old age who is young. His brother is dead, and he alone is left of his mother's children, and his father loves him. Listen, Now Benjamin is the favorite son, and the brothers are acknowledging that and pleading for Benjamin. Do you see the difference in them now? They hated Joseph and wanted to kill him because he was their father's favorite, but their attitude toward Benjamin is different. This is why Joseph contrived this. He wanted to find out what his brothers really believed. Have they changed? Have they repented? Are they better? Or are they the same brothers who sold me, what, 22 years ago? And we have said to my Lord, the lad cannot leave his father, for if he should leave his father would die. These were the same brothers that didn't care that they brought the coat of many colors, that they had dipped in animal blood and shredded and brought that back to Jacob and said, draw your own conclusion with what happened to your son. But you said to your servants, unless your youngest brother comes down with you, you shall see my face no more. So it was when we went up to your servant, my father, that we told him the words of my Lord. And our father said, go back and buy us a little food. But we said, we cannot go down if our youngest brother is with us. If our youngest brother is with us, then we will go down. For we may not see the man's face unless our youngest brother is with us. Then your servant, my father, said to us, you know that my wife bore me two sons. And the one went out from me, and I said, surely he is torn to pieces, and I have not seen him since. But if you take this one also from me, and calamity befalls him, you shall bring down my gray hair with sorrow to the grave. Now, therefore, when I come to your servant, my father, and the lad is not with us, since his life is bound up in the lad's life, pause. That's a great description of a relationship between a parent and a child. Our lives are bound up in our children's lives. And they can be our joy and they can be our heartache. And you young people can be the joy or the heartache of your parents, depending on how you handle yourself at this point in your life. It will happen when he sees that the lad is not with us, that he will die. So your servants will bring down the gray hair of your servant, our father, with sorrow to the grave. For your servant became surety for the lad to my father, saying, if I do not bring him back to you, then I shall bear the blame before my father forever. Now, therefore, please let your servant remain instead of the lad as a slave to my Lord, and let the lad go up with his brothers. For how shall I go up to my father if the lad is not with me, lest perhaps I see the evil that would come upon my father? Judah is now ready to give his life up so Benjamin can go back and be with Jacob. Then Joseph could not restrain himself before all those who stood by him, and he cried out, make everyone go out from me. So no one stood with him while Joseph made himself known to his brothers. And he wept aloud, and the Egyptians in the house of Pharaoh heard it. And Joseph said to his brothers, I am Joseph. Does my father still live? What do you think was running through the minds of his brothers? This man that they had been before, this great Egyptian, powerful prime minister, if you will, who held their fate in his hands. And they're trying to take it all in that this is Joseph, who we thought was dead. His brothers could not answer him, for they were dismayed in his presence. And Joseph said to his brothers, please come near to me. And they came near, and he said, I am Joseph, your brother, whom you sold into Egypt. But now do not, therefore, be grieved or angry with yourselves, because you sold me here. Listen, folks, this is the key to being godly through all the difficulties that come to us in life. For God sent me before you to preserve life. For these 2 years, the famine has been in the land, and there are still 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvesting. And God sent me before you to preserve a posterity for you in the earth and to save your lives by a great deliverance. So now it was not you who sent me here, but God. And he has made me a father to Pharaoh and Lord of all of his house and a ruler throughout all the land of Egypt. Joseph believed in the providence of God. And this gave Joseph the strength to do what I think is one of the hardest commands that God gives us in this life. And that's to forgive people that hurt you. I think that's one of the hardest commands that God gives us in this life. When somebody's hurt you, they've hurt someone you love, they've hurt your child, they've hurt your husband or your wife, your mother, your father. When real damage has come into your life because of what somebody else did, and then God says, you're to forgive your enemies and pray for them. Pray for those who spitefully use you and abuse you. Seek their good. Seek their well-being. I'm going to tell you, Joseph didn't have the example of the Lord yet. He hadn't heard the Lord say, Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they do. Joseph has such love and regard for God and the providence of God and the working of God in his life that he can say to his brothers, you're really not the ones who did this. They did, and he knew they were responsible. But what I'm trying to say is Joseph saw things in a broader light, in a bigger picture. And the only way he can do that and the only way we can do that is if we are godly. Because if we're not, all these things that Joseph went through that we're going to experience probably in some degree or another in our lives, they will turn us bitter. They will turn us away from God. They will turn us into disobedient children of God if we let them take root in our hearts. If we do not handle our circumstances and our environment the way Joseph did, these things will ruin us. In chapter 50, after Jacob dies, Joseph's brothers are now worried. Now that Dad is gone, what is he going to do? Verse 15, when Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, perhaps Joseph will hate us and may actually repay us for all the evil which we did to him. So they sent messengers to Joseph saying, before your father died, he commanded saying, thus you shall say to Joseph, I beg you, please forgive the trespass of your brothers and their sin, for they did evil to you. Now please forgive the trespass of the servants of God, of the God of your father. And Joseph wept when they spoke to him. It was not through gritted teeth. It was not, oh, well, because Dad asked me to, I guess I won't do what I could do. He weeps because his brethren are worried that he's now going to bring his wrath against them. Then his brothers also went down, watch this, and fell down before his face and said, behold, we are your servants. Just like God said. I mean, this is not the first time they've done it. They did it when they came in begging for grain. But now they do it voluntarily, just because of who Joseph is. Is not God glorious and wonderful in what he sees in the future and what he brings about through his sovereign will? This is why, whether it was advisable or not, it was good that Joseph did tell them the dream at 17. Because they, from that point on, knew what had happened was the will of God. And Joseph said to them in verse 19, do not be afraid. Listen, for am I in the place of God? Am I in the place of God? As for you, you meant evil against me. He acknowledges that. He doesn't assuage that in any way. He doesn't let him off the hook. You meant evil against me, but God meant it for good in order to bring it about as it is this day to save many people alive. This ties all the way back into where we started on Sunday morning in class with God working out a plan. God working out a redemptive plan to save man and the promises he made to Abraham. And we see it now actually being acted out through the evil choices that men made. But also through the integrity of a godly man who overcame the evil choices that were made. What a testament to the glory and the power, the omniscience, the omnipotence of God. But it's a testament to Joseph. And you know what it tells me? It tells me that it can be done. We can live a godly life. And we, not one of us, has the right to excuse our ungodliness and blame it on somebody else. We do not have that right. We are not products of evolution. We are not just a product of our society or our culture or our upbringing. We have choices to make. And when we make those choices and they are evil choices, we are responsible for them. And we've done it in the face, flying in the face of God. Because God can take anybody in any circumstance and make that person what He wants them and what He needs them to be. The question is, are we willing to do it? Are we willing to submit ourselves to God for that use like Joseph was? What an awesome, what an inspiring example this man is. And to impress, not to pick on, but to impress you younger folks one more time, he was your age, many of you, when he started this process. You can do it. You can come through your culture. You can come through your conditioning. You can come through less than stellar family circumstances and be the young man or young woman God wants you to be. And who knows what He can accomplish through you? We'll never know if you don't work with Him and believe in Him and trust in Him and obey Him and give yourself over to His use. We'll never know what you could have accomplished. But if you're devoted to the Lord and you are cooperative with Him and you have faith in Him, you can do great things. I'm not saying you'll be a great person in the eyes of the world, but you can do great things if you're doing the things of God. Joseph is such a powerful example of that. If there's a way that we can be of help to you as we draw our thoughts to a close tonight and our service to a close, we want to sing a song of encouragement and inspiration to you. And maybe in some things that we've been examining tonight from Joseph's life and considering the power and providence of God, perhaps you've come to a realization in yourself that things are not right and you need to change and you need to grow and you need to be more cooperative with God. If there's a way we can help you in that process, or again, perhaps you need to go home and spend some time with God in prayer. But if there's a way we can help you together while we're here to pray or give you words of encouragement, we would love to do that or help you in any other way with your relationship with God to make it what it ought to be, while we're standing and singing.